Welcome to the second episode of Figuring Out Fanfiction. I'm your host, Leonza Reyes, and it is so exciting to be here. Today is our first episode with an official guest, and we have a wonderful guest here with us today. But before I introduce them, I want everyone listening to this to consider a few facts that I found on the internet. It's no secret that there's a lack of diversity in general media, and it's in the conversation all the time. Whether it comes from race, nationality, class, religion, or sexuality, it's everywhere, really. Let's look at the state of representation at that last one, especially in film. Every year, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, known as GLAAD, does a count of LGBTQ representation in film. Now, over time, representation between the gay and lesbian community has increased, but maybe slowly. Let's look at the 2018 findings. Only 18.2% of the films that GLAAD counted included characters that identified as LGBTQ. Among those, there was an equal representation between gay and lesbian characters. And this might seem a bit of a victory, but still, not quite. Of all the LGBTQ identifying characters, none were transgender or non-binary. And again, that's only in the 18.2% of the counted movies. Now, for an LGBTQ identifying fan, it's certainly not satisfying to see those numbers. If heterosexual folks always see themselves on the screen or pages, why can't other communities see themselves? And that's where fanfiction comes in. Fanfiction becomes a portal or an opportunity for fans to create representation in their favorite works of media. They can create new characters they can relate to or bend an existing character to better relate to. But are there any possible consequences to writing characters for representation? Surely not, right? Today's guest is PhD student James Warwood. They're currently at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and they'll be giving us their insight on what it means to create one's own representation in existing works, especially with a focus on a paper they wrote in 2015. That's actually how I found them and reached out to interview on this podcast. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start this podcast, which I like to do, with a few icebreaker questions. So tell us about yourself, a little bit about your research, and how you actually first encountered fanfiction personally.
So my name is James. I am a grad student at UW-Madison. I'm working in composition and rhetoric, which is in the English department. I focus on queer and trans rhetorics, talking about how non-binary and gender non-conforming people use images, and specifically Instagram, to explore, create, and perform their gender identities. So that's what I'm working on right now. I've kind of dabbled in other areas during my master's program. I did literature and did do some work on fan fiction. As far as coming to fan fiction, I feel like I was probably, you know, in my early teens when it like first occurred to me to go out and look for this kind of stuff. And my fandom at the time was the TV show House. But for the most part, you know, in the last, 15 years, I've mostly been into Harry Potter, but also a bit of like the BBC show Sherlock.
I guess to start off with with the rest of what we want to touch on, what brought you to studying your specific rhetoric and composition?
So I've always been really interested in how, you know, people talk about themselves. And then as I started, you know, thinking about my own gender and my own gender identity, I started questioning how people create their identities or like come to their identities and then perform them in a way that other people can or cannot read or understand them. So that was the kind of work that I did for my master's thesis. And then when I was applying to PhD programs, I started thinking about how there are tools in like this kind of sub area of queer rhetoric and trans rhetoric that give me ways to think about how non-binary and gender non-conforming people use what I'll call, you know, cis heteronormative gender symbols. So things like clothing, body hair, language, in a way to, I guess, create their non-conforming identity. And I've become really interested in specifically how people do that visually through, you know, Instagram primarily is where I focus on. And so even though I came from literature, rhetoric has a lot to offer for me in terms of tools for asking the kind of questions that I have.
Why do you think people write fan fiction in the first place?
That's a really good question. I know that, I mean, obviously, all kinds of different reasons. For myself, for when I've talked to other people who write or, you know, otherwise create for fan fiction, it's partly a means of participating in this fandom, in this universe that has been created, you know, by an author or a show's creator. So it's a way to participate, a way to contribute to that universe in some way. But also, I think it's a way to, in that participation, a way to create some kind of representation or way that they can more personally identify with either the storylines or the characters, a combination of those. Yeah.
You wrote about fan fiction in what was originally a presentation, I believe, right?
Right.
And it was called "What About Us: Creating Queer Representation in Fan Fiction." That's how I found about you and your work. In a summary, could you tell us a little bit what it's about and what brought you to write about it specifically?
So I kind of came to this project. It was not related in any way to anything I was doing. I was just, you know, kind of had this idea in the back of my brain that, you know, maybe I could actually do something with fan fiction that's scholarly, and that would be kind of cool. And I used it as an opportunity to pretty much legitimize my passion for fan fiction in a way, so that I didn't feel like, you know, I was wasting my time in some ways. So that's kind of how I came to it. And very briefly, the paper talks about how fan fiction works as a means for LGBTQ fans to create representation of themselves in popular media. So I think, as you mentioned, this particular paper focuses on the show Sherlock. And basically what I'm talking about is how fans who watch the show will create fan fiction that very, especially for this fandom, I would say it's most common for fan fiction to focus on a romantic and or sexual relationship between Sherlock and John Watson. There's a lot of kind of history there that I explore in the paper, but it's kind of boring, so I won't go over that. And the kind of what I'm talk about in the paper is talking about a specific scene at the beginning of, or in the first episode of the series, where, you know, John confronts Sherlock about any potential relationships that he's in, and a little bit, very small conversation about Sherlock's supposed sexuality in that moment. And I juxtapose that scene, that canonical scene that exists in the show, with a similar scene in a fan fiction that I had read, you know, long before writing the paper, that basically reproduces that scene in terms of setting, dialogue, but there's a slight situational change where basically the trajectory of the scene changes. So instead of You know, in the TV show, Sherlock and John kind of are portrayed as supposedly, you know, two heterosexual men. If we don't get like a firm yes or no about whether or not Sherlock is gay or, you know, asexual in the show, which leads to all kinds of, you know, explorations of that in fan fiction, a lot of conversations in fandom about the potential for queerness in the show. But I talk about how fanfic authors have rewritten, you know, that specific scene that I talk about or other elements of Sherlock, and use that as a tool to rewrite it in a way that allows for that queerness.
So as you mentioned, it really is all about how consumers, specifically of Sherlock, consciously bend a character's sexuality, especially if it's vague, to create representation for themselves. Do you think that's generally harmful or helpful to the community at large?
So I would say that it's really a tradition of the LGBTQ community to look for themselves in existing media or, you know, other, I don't know, texts, I guess. And basically making space or making do with what is available. So obviously there's a imbalance, I would say, between the cis heteronormative kind of image that is in popular media and fair, realistic representations of LGBTQ people in the media. So I would say that, you know, when fans are interacting with this media, they're looking for, you know, whatever they can find. If they are watching Sherlock, where Sherlock's questions of Sherlock's sexuality are fairly vague and not, you know, addressed super explicitly on the show, I would say that seeing that a fan who is, you know, maybe queer themselves or you know, asexual or some other, you know, identity that they can relate to in some way to what they're seeing on the screen, I mean, I think that that's very much a powerful tool that LGBTQ fans have, is being able to find places where, unfortunately, there isn't adequate representation, and being able to creatively make that representation for themselves. I don't know if that answered your question, but...
No, that does. That does. You talk a lot about how that is a powerful tool. When fans do this, is it mostly to also satisfy readers based on their interpretation? Or is it, you know, really just more focused on projecting on... And I don't say projection in a negative way, but more so projecting themselves to only basically see themselves. So more so of seeing themselves in a character rather than reinterpreting the text in a person's own personal perspective.
Good question. I would feel comfortable saying that it's a little bit of both. So like I said, queer fans, they want to see themselves represented in the media, and it is unfortunately not a very common thing for that to be available. So there is definitely, I would say, especially for, you know, younger fans wanting to have some kind of connection, some kind of representation of, you know, what their identity is, what, especially for younger people who are kind of coming into their identity and figuring out what who they are. I definitely think like there's some projection there happening that where, you know, they see a space or a lack and kind of put themselves into that context. And then that becoming a way of, you know, getting into fan fiction as a way to create and expand on or support that projection, and then the way that that informs their interpretation of the canonical work. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously it'd be a little bit of both. It could be different for everybody, but I think that particularly for younger people who I feel like, maybe it's just based on my experience, but I feel like younger people, teenagers, young adults are more active in fandom. I'll probably get me in trouble. I don't know if that's true or not. based on my experience, I feel like that's kind of what's bringing them to fan fiction is creating that connection based on their identity.
That's especially helpful, like you said, for young adults, because especially if they've never seen themselves on the screen or in the books, they want to be able to see themselves elsewhere, for sure.
Right. Absolutely.
This one is a bit more of a controversial question, and this I got from a suggestion from someone who I was chatting with. But why does the fan fiction community specifically use existing works of fiction to express their needs for representation? Why don't they just seek out current released works that do include decent or appropriate representation, or try to create their own content?
Right. And it's definitely a really complicated question, especially in terms of when I gave this paper, you know, 5 years ago, a lot of the questions that I got were about, you know, the legality of fan fiction and copyright law. So there's a lot of questions about that, and I won't go into it because I don't actually have a lot of the ins and outs. I just know that particular creators of, you know, canonical works, so J.K. Rowling, for example, tends to be more lenient, I would say, in terms of whether fans are creating these unauthorized fan works, whereas other authors, creators, I know that George R.R. Martin is somebody who really despises fan fiction and when people use his work in this way. Mm-hmm. So that's complicated. And as far as why somebody would use, you know, the existing work rather than looking elsewhere, I think part of it is definitely that lack of representation in mainstream popular media. So a show like Sherlock or a fandom like Harry Potter that has such a huge popular reach, you know, people are going to be watching that and consuming it and enjoying it anyway. I think that it's for, you know, certain fans, for LGBTQ fans who are looking for this representation, you know, in any kind of media, when they're enjoying something like Sherlock, it might feel kind of natural to be creating that kind of queerness that may or may not exist in subtext. So I think that kind of just probably happens naturally as they're consuming this media that is already super popular. Mm-hmm. Certainly they could turn to other, you know, shows, movies, books that do include LGBTQ representation. However, I would say it's very unfortunately common for those works, for those representations to be, you know, defined by harmful stereotypes. So even though a character may be trans, for example, they may be characterized as somebody who, you know, fits a harmful trope. So, for example, you'll often see trans characters who are in some way portrayed as almost villainous. So liars, tricksters, characters who are negatively viewed as people who are, I guess, telling, I don't want to say telling lies, but telling untruths, I'll say.
About. Deceiving.
Yeah, deceiving. Right. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. deceiving others about their gender. So you've got, you know, those harmful stereotypes that exist in other types of media. And certainly, you know, folks will go ahead and create their own work that isn't related in any way to you existing media. Certainly, I would say that that's not for everybody. There's something about fan fiction where you already have this kind of universe, like a sandbox that you can play in with characters that already exist, histories that are already there, that makes it, I mean, less, at least for in my experience, less labor intensive. So you're not doing all of that kind of foundational imaginative work. It's already there. So I think it makes it in some ways more, it's this creation endeavor more accessible to people who are maybe not, who maybe don't identify as creative writers, for example, who don't enjoy writing short stories of their own imagination. And so since they fan fiction allows folks to use that existing content, it puts them in control of how those characters are perceived or how those storylines are changed or what happens in a way that if they're, you know, turning to other media, they don't really have that opportunity.
But do you think writing fan fiction, you know, characters and settings and using it to create representation for LGBTQ and the trans community, do you think it can impact the community, whether for better or for worse, outside the fan fiction world?
So possibly. I don't know that I would say, based on my limited experience in my very small fan fiction bubble. And I think that part of the, I don't want to say problem, but what we have here is a this very insular community of fans in this fandom, for whatever the, you know, show or movie or whatever is. So it's rare sometimes, I would say, for what's happening in that fandom to leak out into mainstream culture. It does happen, particularly for Sherlock, for example. Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman are frequently asked about fan fiction, fan art, other fan creations that are circulating on the internet.
Oh yeah,
they'll go on, you know, late night talk shows, and the host will bring out artwork that fans have created about, you know, a sexual relationship between John and Sherlock. And so it does in that way kind of leak out into mainstream consciousness, whether or not it's making any kind of impact on, you know, the greater LGBTQ community is probably debatable. And I say that partially because there is such a stigma for people who are fans in a way that they create, you know, fan fiction, fan arts, fan videos, any kind of creative work as a fan. There tends to be
absolutely
like a negative stigma that when, if there is this kind of conversation that's leaking out into the mainstream, I feel like there's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to push away from whatever that's is coming out of fandom, to kind of say those people, those fans are weird, and they don't speak for us. We don't want to identify with whatever they're saying. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's it's not because of, you know, the queer creative work that the fans are doing so much as it's just a longstanding kind of attitude towards people who are fans of mainstream works. I feel like particularly fans of Star Trek, for example, are a common, mm-hmm. common references in pop culture of fans who get carried away and then are seen as, I don't want to say not trustworthy, but eccentric in a way that they're not always taken seriously.
Moving, you know, you're talking about on the same vein of fan fiction, there's definitely fan fiction out there that contains themes of homophobia, transphobia, even hate crimes. And, you know, while there are people out there in the world who argue that these themes still need to be out there in media in general, do you think that's explicitly harmful to the LGBTQ community? Or are there, you know, maybe so-called advantages to having, you know, this type of themes out there in the fan fiction world?
Right. That's a really good question. I guess what I'll say is that certainly fan fiction works as a space for, I mean, I guess I'll say like as a safe space for LGBTQ fans who are creating this world where they're represented, where they feel like they're being recognized for who they are and are able to see, even if it's not on a screen, they're able to see themselves in these popular characters. So that's definitely, I mean, so as a safe space, that's fandom. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say that, you know, in real life, it's not free of homophobia, transphobia, violence, and abuse, which is obviously super unfortunate. But I think that when, you know, fanfic authors bring in kind of these themes that exist in real life that, you know, probably these same fans are experiencing in their own lives, I think that that can really, I guess, make it, I don't want to say relatable because I don't want to situate fans in the way where they're, that's the only way that they experience their identity is in that negative way. But I think that certainly it's helpful for some fans to have that, have those themes present, like them being able to access that, if it's helpful for them to make that connection to real life, I suppose. Obviously for others, it's very much an intrusion on that safe space that they have been creating for themselves. So I would imagine there's an intentional avoidance of those themes. As far as whether or not it's generally or explicitly harmful, beyond those aspects of not really advantages, but some ways where I could understand why it's a common theme is, mm-hmm. So when you're looking at fan fiction, you know, on a website like Archive of Our Own, authors have the ability to include tags and warnings. Those kinds of things will include character deaths, abuse, potential non-consensual sexual acts. And I think that having those kind of warnings explicitly stated in the information about a fan fiction can be taken as a signal that the author of that work is not intending harm. So I want to be slightly optimistic in thinking that nobody's going to be writing fan fiction with, you know, transphobic themes with the explicit intention of harming potential trans readers. But it's possible. I mean, there's all kinds of people out there. But I would say that if you have those warnings explicitly stated, though, I would imagine that, you know, the goal of that author is probably something along the lines of trying to, you know, address or analyze themes of, you know, homophobia or violence towards the LGBTQ community in a way mm-hmm. that could be helpful. So like I said, maybe helping other fans kind of process themes like that are in their own lives. So in that sense, I feel like it could be helpful. If there are people out there who are maybe not including those warnings, who are writing in a way that isn't in some way critically engaging with those themes, then I would say, it would be harmful. It has to be done right, basically, for me to say that it's not terrible.
Yeah, there's a very thin line between what, I guess, you know, you can't really argue it's black and white, but there's a really thin line between what might be harmful and what might not be harmful.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, it also depends on, you know, every reader is going to get something different out of a fan fiction. So if they're reading, one person might read it and not feel, you know, distressed by whatever is being covered in the fan fiction. Someone else might feel triggered and have to, you know, stop altogether engaging with that work. There's a thin line, but also it's so much based on an individual's personal experiences and like what they're bringing to their engagement with that fan fiction.
One of the questions I'd like to end with wrapping up is, again, bringing it beyond and, you know, beyond the screen, outside of archiveofourown.org, for example, do you think as a whole, you know, society has somewhat changed its tune overall to the LGBTQ community? Or do you think the rhetoric and the treatment remain mostly the same?
Broadly, yes, I feel like things have improved. Obviously, if you look between now and like even 50 years ago, things are significantly different and in general, better. And you can see that both in the ways that folks, you know, celebrities, for example, are more open about their gender identities, their sexualities. There are non-discrimination ordinances in, you know, different cities and states. But at the same time, you know, in the last 4 years in this country, there have been a lot of policy changes that have significantly diminished the legal, the civil rights of LGBTQ Americans specifically. We also, you know, there's against, you know, trans women of color, for example. So while certainly things are better in terms of in the wider context of, and, you know, keeping us from equality, for going back to looking at media, you can see the same kind of shift, I would say, in the presence of LGBTQ characters in popular media. But we can also look at, you know, for example, thinking about that show Modern Family having a queer or a same-sex couple as, you know, one of their main characters on the show is something that, you know, it's 2020. Many years ago, a couple decades ago, would probably not have been something that you would see. But at the same time, in, you know, movies, TV shows, you frequently see
what, hopefully that destination is a final good.
Yes, hopefully we get there, you know, in our lifetime. That would be awesome.
That would be great.
Can be optimistic. Queer characters and especially trans characters being played by cis heteronormative or heterosexual actors. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit of you know, both. Yes, it's improving, but obviously we're not there yet.
Well, James, one last question. Where can people find you or learn more about you if you're willing to, you know, talk about that a little bit, if they want to email you or get in touch with you?
I'm like one of the few people, I feel, of my generation who I don't have a Twitter. I don't have like a personal website. I do have a my university email that I am happy to take. I'm always happy to have conversations about this one project that I did about fan fiction, because it is kind of a pet project of mine that, like I said, has nothing to do with what I'm quote unquote officially doing in my scholarship currently, but it's always fun to kind of revisit it and talk about it with folks who are interested. So I would say that, yeah, my email, which is just the warwood@wisc.edu, is the best way to get in touch with me and have a conversation about fan fiction, which is my favorite kind of conversation to have.
I'm so glad that the paper you wrote was about Sherlock and John specifically, because when I think back to my teenage years, that is one of the things that like stands out, is like Sherlock and John, like the amount of right. fan fiction. Were you ever a big fan of fan mixes, like those like mixtapes?
Absolutely. That's like where I've gotten most of my music over the last, honestly, like 15 years is from fan mixes. And when I hear a song that's came from a fan mix, all I can think about is, you know, John Locke, for example. It's in my brain.
Yeah. That's, I'm in the exact same boat. One of like my hyperfixations of my youth was specifically the film, and you know, I think that I would say the musical version of Les Miserables. And so all of my music comes from fan mixes that I found from that. And wow. And it's good music, don't get me wrong. It's actually introduced me to a few of my favorite bands, which I think is another right. thing you could definitely talk about in terms of the world of fan fiction.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've made so many of like, yeah, music connections, and also finding other shows or other movies or other books that I like, people, you know, in fan fiction or, you know, in the on Tumblr, people just kind of in passing mentioning these other texts or music. And so much of what I've things that I enjoy now basically have come through those other connections, all originating in fan fiction. So powerful.
Well, James, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Awesome to talk with you. I really appreciate you asking to have this conversation with me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I can have an opportunity to talk about John Locke and how it might change the world, theoretically speaking, I always am willing to have that. Thank you so much for your time. And I hope in this pandemic period, you stay safe.
And there you have it. There are stories out there of how fanfiction allowed people to see themselves in the stories they love. If you have any questions for me, you can always reach out on figuringoutfanfiction@gmail.com. Feel free to even send me your stories about how fanfiction actually increased representation for you. Next week, I'll be joined by Professor Gareth Fisher, who currently teaches at Syracuse University. We'll be talking about how fanfiction has actually held its place in literature, or in just general fiction, for a long time. And yes, that could possibly mean that Shakespeare is actually a fanfic writer. Thanks for listening in today. Tune in next week.